Rick, are you recording? Because mine just bombed out.
I'm double recording, my friend. Double! 3-2-1 rule. One failed. I got two others. One in the cloud, one in my pocket right here, buddy.
So I was just trialing that EVA software. You know, I thought I'd give it a good run in before I cough up and pay for it, and it'll only record the first 5 minutes in trial mode.
Oh,
be a short podcast.
In tech we trust. People in charge we're not sure about.
Let's rock it then. Episode 14. Here we are. There's three of us today. Myself, Nigel Poulton, Rick Vanover.
Hey, sorry I missed the last episode, guys. I truly, truly had a migraine.
You were almost becoming a regular.
Almost. I've got some availability issues, but no, I had this migraine like knocked me down, guys. It was rough.
Yeah, speaking of availability issues, Gabriel, you were kind of on the last show and then you weren't.
Oh, tell me about it. You know, so, I mean, life interrupt us. I thought I could do multitasking in the scope of driving my daughter to the doctor, being in the car, and talking on Skype on mobile, and all three failed.
So, you got your daughter to the doctor, though, yeah?
Yeah, I did get my daughter to the doctor. I was listening, and I was like, oh, I'm like, I had this great thing I wanted to say, and I started to speak for a second, and then drop. And I'm like, okay, it's just my luck. You know what? I'll let Hans and company run with it.
Yeah. You know what? Technology works like a treat when you've got nothing good to say. And as soon as you got something good to say, boom, there you go. And it fails on you.
That's how it goes.
It is. Yeah. Anyway, so something that we did talk about last week, but we didn't spend a massive amount of time on it. Hans and I didn't really think it was current news last week. We thought it was really from the week before, was the whole NetApp EvoRail thing. Now, Gabriel, I know that you did have some opinion on that. You weighed in on Chuck's blog. And I think, well, it felt to me like you took the gloves off a little bit there. I know that you respect Chuck and you get on well with him. But then I've had Nick Howell on Twitter again today saying, you know, I think you guys need to give it a bit more attention. And we're maybe missing some fundamental concepts here. So, Gabriel, what are your thoughts on the whole piece?
Well, you know, when I first saw that NetApp was joining and going to come out with an EvoRail-based solution, at first I thought, well, yeah, I think the comment I made to Chuck or somebody else was, it's like plugging a USB keyboard into a BlackBerry. You're layering another storage, you know, solution on top of something that already has as a key value.
No way.
Denied.
I know where he's going. He's talking about.
It didn't really happen again.
We're having a laugh.
I'm home
about
too. I'm on my home. You know, they've been doing cable work today. So to pick up where I left off. If I put myself into the corporate, you know, I'm, you know, I want to stay relevant. I want to have something that's part of, you know, an ecosystem, aka a hyperconverged. It has a lot of traction in it and I'm not a server manufacturer. Well, then, you know, I can see certain customer use cases where they do want rich file services that they want to level on top of it. And so, you know, none of the hyperconverged systems do SIFS natively. They don't do NFS from a file services to provide file usage to the customer. So it's not native NFS. It still ends up being just a storage protocol. Oddly enough, in vSAN, it's a, from what I understand, a proprietary communication between vSAN nodes. So, you know, it's kind of VMware's own thing that they run with. So I could see certain customers who might want to do that. I can't see a whole lot of them though.
Well, and you know, you hit on a number of things. And I like to say that when it comes to the storage, for virtual environments, it's a huge shift to make a big change. Like, okay, I have this household name of storage, whatever it is. I'm going to stop using that and I'm going to go with this new thing. Any version one technology, that's a real tough sell to any company, small, medium, or large. So I actually think I'm taking it a different way. NetApp's kind of commitment to this platform in the broadest sense, in some way, is brilliant. First of all, they're the only big name. HP has some options too, right? But I think that it's a real commitment to the platform. And consider, a lot of these people already have NetApp storage. So, you know, if you're a NetApp shop and you're looking at these type of technologies, you might not use the vSAN bit. Sure, it's there. Maybe that's your test dev storage. Maybe that's your whatever storage. That's fine. But you have this other NetApp infrastructure you can't ignore, especially for virtualized environments, you know, the connectivity options you'll need between. I actually think it's a good move. However, I know that not everyone is so happy. Our good friend Greg Farrow has posted a very controversial post about vSAN, which is really one of the underlying technologies of how EvoRail will provide storage. He's posted that because it uses unreliable multicast, it's really critically at risk. Now, I like Greg, but everyone knows he likes to kind of pick on things. I'm not a network guy. I'd look to him for network questions, but the multicast bit might be an issue. But I look at the bigger picture of it's version one, and in the end, VMware is going to make it right. And a name like NetApp behind it for the end state, the end device, I think that's really going to help. So long or the short, I think it's a good thing.
So just on Greg's article, and we'll put the link to that in the show notes. I've not read it, actually. Does he talk whereabouts or what the role in the architecture that the multicast has?
Oh, he does. He talks about packet replication and switches. He talks about IGMP snooping. And it's a truly, truly convincing argument about the trustworthiness. It truly is. But I can't officially say he's right. I gotta imagine, because VMware writes the kernel, which derives the network,
yeah,
maybe there's something missing. I don't know. But...
because, Gabriel, weren't you just saying that there was something about proprietary comms on the back end of vSAN?
It's not even so much... It's the storage protocol. It's not like it's leveraging NFS or iSCSI or Fibre Channel. It's the discussion between, you know, the nodes that share the storage portion of it that is somewhat proprietary, as I understand it. You know, one of the things that, I mean, I would take issue with Greg's initial thing on, you know, snooping and whatnot. I mean, the only way somebody's going to snoop is if they have, you know, access, you know, to that particular switch. If you look at the architecture of an EvoRail, you know, the discussion between nodes from the vSAN aspect, which will probably, let's face it, if you look at what that platform is designed towards, robo, small branch office, you know, small dev and test environments, the problem is we're going to be plugging that all into the same 10 gig switch. You know, if you want high availability and redundancy, then they'll plug both of the 10 gig ports into two, you know, fabric A, fabric B, for, you know, lack of a lesser term. That's just intern node communication at storage level. You know, it's kind of like, you know, when you set up, like, say, an Equilogic unit years ago, you created a dedicated switch infrastructure as a best practice for your iSCSI traffic and put all your traffic on that one. You could do the same thing in a vSAN instance, and it could ride on the same set of 10 gig networking switches that you would use for, you know, your NetApp system or any other iSCSI or NFS-based storage solution. So I don't see really that much. And, you know, granted, I'm not like a big network security guy, so maybe I just don't see the issue with this, but I don't think it's as big of a deal as Greg may be making out.
Well, Greg highlights probably some of the catch points on, and I, you know, we'll put the link in the article, but Greg says, I like these four bullet points. 5-year-old switches are probably going to be a problem. Cheap switches are going to use a different type of ASICs and might have transfer issue, specifically around rates. He recommends getting an expensive switch, and then he critiques the fact that Ethernet is the underlying protocol for Mac to Mac foolishness. I'm not making this up. Now, here's the thing. We all know if packets aren't delivered to storage, there's going to be a problem. You know, the SCSI protocol does not do well with significant interruptions, and we all can agree on that. So I think Greg's, you know, content is worth a look. However, one thing VMware and NetApp have always been exceptionally good at is reference architecture, recommended configuration. Yeah, EvoRail is kind of thrown out there as this just throw it in type of solution, but the VMware side of VMware is going to come out, and the NetApp side of NetApp is going to come out. There's going to be very specific reference architectures. There's going to be professional services. There's going to be solution architects that get the stuff in correctly. And just like any technology, that's a risk you take. You have to do it right.
Well, you can already see that Rawlinson has popped in, and it's the first comment on Greg's post to lay out some of the differences and why he disagrees. And, you know, and he is definitely one of the go-to people within VMware to talk about that, so it's probably worth reading what his comment has to say. You know, I think losing context of what EvoRail is. First, it's a very small implementation vehicle. You know, you're talking at its base, it's 100 virtual machines on a 2U box. We're not talking, you know, giant data center technology here. We're talking very specific niche use cases for the very first instance and first pass. And even if it could scale, you know, it did scale to 32 nodes. I don't think you're going to see many customers that would do so, right? And I think it's one of the flaws with EvoRail is that the restrictions in how it's currently implemented and packaged restrict it to some very specific use cases, and it's not this broad panacea or be all to a lot of data centers. You know, especially the fact that you cannot manage it with your existing VMware infrastructure. I see that as a big challenge, right? I have a set island of virtual resources that are all on their own. They have their own management platform and management console and implementation structure. And I already have virtualization. Well, I can't manage that in conjunction with this EvoRail appliance that I've put in. Now, I can see use cases where that's perfectly fine. Let's say I put it in a DMZ and I want it completely isolated. Great. Now I can do that with the EvoRail system. It's perfect match. But I think you'll see that product mature. And I think it is kind of, a me too thing for a lot of the OEMs who don't have a hyperconverged play or whose hyperconverged technology isn't very robust or selling, right?
Now, Gabe, but you know, you know the most about the categorical hyperconverged and you left that segment. Does that, you know, reading between the lines tell me anything? Ooh, tough questions on In Tech We Trust. I don't know. I'm just saying, I am slow to change. This is a big change, and I am just wait and see. If I had money to blow, I'd give it a try. But when you see big names lining up, especially to latch on to other storage, I think that's a good thing. That's the takeaway. And I think in version 2 or beyond, it'll all get sorted is my takeaway.
No. It's not that I don't believe in it, and that's definitely not the case. I think that I have several reasons for why I moved out of that, the group that I worked with, right? And you know, not all of them are something I can talk about publicly. I do think that space is quickly crowding. I think that for certain players in the space, they'll have more success than others who will be what I kind of consider the walking wounded or the walking dead. Who kind of, you know, muddle about for a number of years or for a period of time until, you know, what is the exit strategy? They get bought or they IPO. Will they get to a certain level where they can sell enough of their product and have a robust enough solution that will allow them to IPO, aka that magical $200 million run rate? Don't know yet. You know, they may have limitations with the architecture, and I've evaluated all the solutions. I mean, I've talked to pretty much everybody out there, and I follow the space pretty heavily as it's something I'm interested in. But then I see some other aspects of it too, where it's like, there are a bunch of companies that you've never heard of, that, you know, very few people have actually heard of, that are still on stealth, that, and then there's even some of the larger OEMs themselves have kind of sit back and said, let's watch this and look at the mistakes that these early entrants do. And then we will come back with our own strategy with a platform that will make up for the pitfalls or the shortcomings that they have and will be kind of like the, you know, it's kind of like you look at the very first instance of eBlock, the very first pass of Arcadia when it came out. It wasn't quite the great solution. It takes 5 or 6 years to really kind of shake out something that's revolutionary in the data center.
Do you think any of the big vendors have come to market yet then with this almost version 2 hyperconverged platform, you know, where they've learned from those mistakes, or are we still waiting on that?
I think we're right at that point. It's the ecosystem is ready to kick in right now.
Is that a 2015 prediction from you there, Rich?
Sure. Let's mark it on the record.
You know, I think you're going to see several other companies making an entrance into this marketplace with solutions that are a little broader in their scope. And let's face it, if I'm EMC or I'm Cisco or I'm IBM or Dell and I come out with my own solution, I have the kind of channel and I have the kind of sales force that I can walk into the top and sell down instead of having to go in from the bottom. An example, it's like I will put on my Cisco hat, and I'm not speaking on behalf of Cisco, but The fact that I have Cisco on my logo on my card means I can go in and talk to a lot of organizations and bring them a concept of a hyperconverged or converged infrastructure platform that they'll probably be more in line to welcome or test or actually implement than I can if I come into this Simplivity or Nutanix without the same kind of risk aversion that I can bring to the table with that big name behind me. Or if EMC comes in and says, hey, you know what? We brought VCE into the fold here. We have this great track record of success with VBlock, and now we're going to start looking at a hyperconverged platform. We have all this knowledge and background that backs us up on why we've made the decisions we've made, and you've bought storage from us for years. Here's another piece of technology you can leverage as well. I deal with really big orgs. I don't play in the SMB space or even the standard enterprise anymore. So it kind of colors my perceptions on how I see things. I see rack-based convergence being a much better solution for a lot of the companies that I talk to on a daily basis versus a standard hyperconverged tech.
So flip it around. You know, we got to wait for something to happen, but I will embellish my first prediction as we close this topic and say that we will see the dust set on hyperconvergence much quicker than the ecosystem around non-rotational storage, right? All these SSD accelerators, tiering. This Wild West has taken a long time to settle. I think it'll do so quicker in hyperconverged.
Fair play. So that's a good pivot there then, Rick. If we can switch across to flash, all-flash arrays, solid state, stuff like that. Just in the news this week, Western Digital, I'm going to say they've picked up SkyEra. I want to say that they mopped up a potential mess there in SkyEra. So they picked them up. They were already one of the major investors in them. They've picked them up for an undisclosed fee. And I think a lot of the initial hype around it was, oh, so is this Western Digital and HGST getting into the all-flash array market? Or I think the second round of opinions was, hang on a sec, this is an undisclosed fee, so they potentially haven't paid very much here. Has the company gone bust? Was it on its knees? Was the technology not shipping? Was it not getting market acceptance? And are they just sweeping up a mess?
Well, I think you have to put it in context with a lot of the other solutions that, you know, that they're looking to purchase. I don't see this necessarily as Western Digital looking to make a play into the storage array marketplace because let's face it, that's not an easy space to jump into if you've just made one component.
No.
You don't have a sales force that is capable, really. And we're not, you know, SkyEra is not a large organization. They're probably sub 75 people.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't think they sold a lot of kit to begin with, but they do have some interesting technology and intellectual property. And sometimes companies are bought for that reason.
They're bought for patents and the like.
Yeah. And potentially talent and stuff, I guess, as well. I mean, I get that you say that they don't have the sales force and they don't have the channel and things like that. And I know that is at least equally as important as good technology. But when you look at the companies that they've picked up recently, they have invested more than $1 billion in flash-based products. So they picked up S-Tech for just under $500 million. They picked up Velabit caching software, a little bit less, okay, $30, $35 million. They picked up Viridant, I think, for over $650 million. Now, Viridant, I remember a while back, they were one of the early players against Fusion.io, so that kind of PCIe-based flash storage. They've invested over $1 billion in product, which is kind of strange for a flash manufacturer, I would say. Yeah.
Especially when, and here's something that's, I think, interesting. Who's the largest purchaser of flash technology on the planet right now?
Apple.
Just take a guess.
Apple.
It's Apple.
Time out. Funny story on that. What I do at work, we give away USB flash drives. I remember one time our promo supplier said, oh no, we can't do September delivery because of the new iPhone. They seriously disrupt the supply chain with the new iPhone.
Obviously, with Apple buying so much flash storage, then they dictate the way the market goes and the way technology develops. And he was talking about TLC versus the likes of SLC and MLC. And you know what? Personally, I think TLC's going to have an interesting future in the enterprise and data center and stuff like that. But all the conversations that I've had with at least the all flash array vendors, then they've got it in Skunkworks and they're trying to think, well, how can we use it in our products and what have you? Because they know they're going to get an awesome price point on it, right?
Sure.
Because of the kind of volumes that you get. with iPhone sales, but just the reliability and then the performance characteristics. I know, right, in enterprise IT and all that kind of stuff, we always end up having to take the consumer technologies, right? The stuff that is ideal for the enterprise just isn't produced in enough volume and it costs too much to produce. So we take stuff from the consumer market and we wrap clever smarts and stuff around it to try and make it last longer, perform better, perform more reliably. But those guys were really telling me they're struggling with TLC. We started out with SLC, didn't we? The super expensive stuff from S-Tech and what have you.
Sure.
And then MLC was that consumer grade stuff that we were kind of, okay, we'll take it. Mm-hmm. TLC seems to be almost a step too far. I don't know. That's from the conversations I've had with
them. Well, you know, you got to look at how the supply chain is going to react. And it's the supply chain is very efficient, but there has to be a decision on what needs to happen. And this is actually something I used to work on a lot back in the day. So I think we'll see this dust settle in a bit. But I don't know. It's really interesting because the Skyera acquisition, like I just did my little Google search on patents. They're very complicated patents that they have. Everything about parity, that's important with lower quality, you know, non-rotational storage systems. Motherboard design, density config, they've got some very, very advanced patents. So I think that's absolutely a factor. And then the supply chain will kick in when they know what to do. Whatever's going to work, the supply chain will do it, and then we'll all win.
Have you ever looked inside a Skyera box?
Does one exist?
Oh, yeah, I mean, I can send you some pictures. I mean, if you look inside one, I've seen one with a case off. It looks like a box with, you know, 75 DIMM slots in it. It's NAND on a stick.
And it's ultra dense, right? That they get a ton of capacity.
That's how they're getting the density in it, right? They've shrunk a lot of that stuff down. And that's why I would think motherboard design would come into play if I have to put 100 DIMM slots in a box.
Well,
now,
just looking through their patents, motherboard is like the very popular word. At least four of them have it in the title. Three of them have it in the title. So,
right.
Yeah, they're definitely shifting the low level, you know, supply chain of high level systems.
Yeah, I mean, and that's what you do. You find a specific niche that you have a specific intellectual property advantage for and you exploit it. You know, and they've had Skyhawk on the market for a while. And I know Sky Eagle had been promised as a, you know, 512 terabyte in a 2U array. Now, a lot of that's done through, you know, trickery, obviously, dedupe and compression and some of the thin provisioning and technologies like that. But that's a lot of storage in 2U. And, you know, I've seen things in, you know, in other companies' R&D efforts where, you know, you're talking multiple petabytes in, you know, 4 and 6U racks. With it being a form of flash storage. And I think that, you know, if you were able to get, to go in and look at what, some of the things that, you know, Facebook is doing, with their storage for like imagery and things like that, you would see that that's probably, you know, a fourth tier flash technology. It's not probably, you know, that we all get to play with on a daily basis, but
yeah.
Petabytes and petabytes of it.
Right. But that's, nobody listening on this call has an application of that scale. So I almost feel those designs are out of reach for it.
They're outside the scope of,
they're
outside the scope of what the vast majority of, you know, outside of 10 to 12 companies or 20 companies on the planet, it's just not something that those people are going to be leveraging. But it does set, you know, those trends. It's kind of like the space missions, right? The space missions created all this great technology and stuff that did have a trickle down effect into the daily use of everyday consumers.
Sure.
It's only a matter of time before that technology trickles down.
But like if you take GPS technology, it was like 30 years, right?
But not Tang.
That's true. All right, Nigel, moving on.
Okay, so here's a good pivot then. So you're talking about, and I think Rick, you were kind of insulting some of our listeners there, saying that none of our listeners have got application profiles like that, but
that's
not
right.
To worry.
That's right. I'll deal with it on Twitter tomorrow. Don't worry.
No worries. Yeah, so did you guys see the Mesosphere stuff in the news, or Mesosphere? I don't know how you guys pronounce it in the States. Those guys have raised, they've had another round of funding, a Series B round of funding, taking them up to close to $50 million US in funding. the whole idea being a data center operating system, right? Now, I think in theory, I kind of get it. So a traditional operating system takes everything inside of a single chassis, right? So everything that you've got plugged onto the motherboard, your CPUs, your DIMMs, your disk drives, your network cards, stuff like that. And it kind of abstracts it and makes it just a pool of resources, right? Like, I don't care how many cores I've got in my desktop or my laptop. And I don't really care how many DIMM slots are in there either. The operating system just abstracts all of that. And I launch whatever, right, a web browser or Outlook or something like that. And the operating system takes care of which CPU, which core it goes on, which areas of memory. I don't bother, okay? But in the data center, right, we're still really picky about where we run our applications. So we're going to run Exchange or SharePoint or CouchDB or whatever, right? And we say, okay, we're going to put it on this storage array and we're going to put it on this set of servers. And, you know, that server, it's got a name. It's Darth Vader or whatever, yeah? And we do all of this kind of hand tuning of our data center. I think I get, and correct me if I'm wrong here, right? But I think I get the idea of a data center operating system as being like, takes the compute, the storage and the networking within a data center and says, you know what? You don't have to worry about it anymore. You just say you want to spin up an application or an instance of an application or scale a particular application and I will decide where in the data center it runs. And I love the idea if that in fact is what they're doing, but it just seems like such an almighty, I don't know, something. Almost. But they've raised 50 million. And you know what? They've got a lot of kudos in the market space at the moment.
The opportunity here is to get that can of unicorn meat where everything's abstracted. Whatever you need, it's there. And if you need more resources, ideally a data center operating system would say, you know, I'm short on storage or compute. Hand me some, turn them on, I will add them to the data center OS pool. You know, they will turn on, they will pixie boot, they will just be used. You know, I think that's great. I really like the idea. And where I think the next step in is the challenge that these types of technologies will face is, how do you ensure service levels? How do you, protect? How do you, do you use RAID, right? Little things like that, maybe, but do you have enough? Do you have backups? All these other things. How do you back this stuff up? How do you protect it? How do you ensure it's going to perform? How do you manage it? How do you cost it? That's the next kind of honestly harder discussion. But I think that this is going to be one of those things that are going to play into the ecosystem and, you know, a good underlying technology rolling into an enterprise brand, then those second waves will actually come easy. So I think this is a good thing, but I got to watch it. I'm not ready to use this in production. I don't talk
The thing
it.
Is though, Rick, I'd kind of hope that a data center operating system would be better than we currently are at doing stuff like that, managing performance and availability and recoverability and HA. Because honestly, I think as IT, we're fairly crap at it at the moment. I've not worked in many organizations where I think that we've got a good grip on performance and we've got a good grip on high availability. It's so manual and we get things wrong so often. Surely the potential there in a data operating system is it can react faster. It can understand the environment better. You know, it doesn't have to go to Excel spreadsheets to find out where we've got capacity.
Ask anybody in the data center, can you tell me about the IO profile for your production tier one workloads?
The answer is no. Always,
no,
surely.
Nobody can. I mean, and that's just the nature of it is that it is that complex. I mean, I'm all for a data center operating system that can abstract away all that complexity and do it properly and give me that ability to sleep well at night. It remains to be seen if that's what this is. I think, I plead ignorance about the platform because I have not had a chance to really read up on it yet, outside of hearing about it on the Structure podcast the other week with Barbaro. But, you know, there are going to be a specific set of customers and workloads that this is probably more geared towards in the beginning. And it's not going to be, you know, your traditional mom and pop IT. It's going to be service integrators. It's going to be the Cognizants and the WePros of the world, the people that are deploying, you know, 30,000 workloads for their customers on a monthly or biannual basis, depending on who that customer might be.
Bang on. And that was why we pivoted to this. I'm really wondering and asking the question, it sounds awesome. And yes, for those web scale guys and those, you know, Facebooks and Googles and Airbnbs and all those kind of people, fair play. But for traditional IT, where, excuse the terminology, right, but generally speaking, decision makers don't have big hairy balls. They tend to go with the really safe options. I mean, this is not a safe option. I'm not saying that the technology isn't good or won't be good, but what a huge gamble to take, right? What a huge change from the standard way of running your environment.
Well, I think when you look at what, you know, you look at what Amazon has done, right? They've made it so simple to turnkey applications or workloads just by swiping your credit card and getting a workload up and running out there. And I think a lot of CIOs and CTOs and organizations of all size look at that model and go, gosh, I wish I could replicate that internally.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that's kind of like, that's where we want to get. We want to get to that point where there's elasticity and flexibility and, you know, setting up a RAID group is not even a concern because the platform doesn't even need to worry about that. You know, the thing is, if somebody comes out with a common data center OS that does all that stuff and makes people, you know, sleep well at night, then by God, they're probably going to sell a metric ass ton of it.
But it wouldn't help you sleep well at night at first, would it? It would, I mean, you wouldn't sleep at night at first. I don't think making such a huge change. Yeah, I love the idea and I'd want to do it, but would I actually be willing to put my neck out on the line there? I don't know.
Yeah. No, and most people aren't, right? And it's funny because I was going through my garage the other day and I was digging through a bunch of stuff and I found a bunch of storage magazine.
Oh, yeah.
Copies of storage magazine from like 2005 and 2006. And it was like, iSCSI, can I trust it in my data center?
Wow.
You know, and the thing is, I mean, the same questions we're asking now about this were the same questions we ask about iSCSI or NFS or any other protocol that has general available acceptance within a lot of data centers today. It's just, you know, all good things come to those who wait. And if the technology has the merit and works as promised, you know, it's not going to be adopted tomorrow. It will be adopted at some point down the chain. It'll be matured upon. And you're seeing the same thing with Docker, and you're going to see it with Rocket and containerization as a whole as it starts to get more, you know, pervasive in the general IT data center.
But the
outside
thing
of
is,
those niche cases, you know, those niche players or niche people that, you know, want to do something like this or have R&D departments that they can, you know, they're not putting their, you know, put it this way. I don't consider a technology production ready until a company that sells something puts their financials on it or puts their paycheck system on it, right? That's when you know that it's okay, for general wide, global adoption is when people's paychecks are riding on it, right? So when I start to see that, then I start to see, well, it's like, now most of the risk has been taken away.
But few things, you know, go back to Storage Magazine, look through every page, you know, they were knocking iSCSI. Why would you not, you know, why would you trust the Ethernet? Sounds familiar to what we talked about just initially with vSAN. Nothing goes away.
Right.
There's a market for everything. And this is honestly what I'd almost call the Internet of Everything. I mean, I know Cisco is using that term and Internet of Things previously, but this is one of those things where there's just more stuff, and some stuff is better suited on new stuff. And because of all this stuff, it's the most generic term, we got to use new stuff. Maybe these new technologies, maybe data center OSs, maybe containers, maybe hyperconversions. I actually bet none of this crap will fail miserably. It'll all still be here in a couple years.
I'm going to coin the term the stuff of stuff right now.
The stuff of stuff.
Stuff of stuff, that's right.
That's what we call the episode right there. I like it. Now, just on this Mesosphere data center OS. So I don't personally think, from what I know about it, which is not a great deal, okay, I don't know that it's particularly a data center operating system. It seems more like an orchestration and configuration platform for managing, you know, these kind of next-gen scale-out apps like Hadoop and Spark and Mongo and Cassandra. I don't know that it actually manages network and storage. It probably does compute, but I'm pretty sure it doesn't do networking and storage at the moment. So probably isn't even to the kind of level of OpenStack yet as a data center operating system.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure it's definitely juvenile of OpenStack. And then that's kind of that second step, the management part. Then there's the whole, okay, I've given you compute, I've given you storage. Am I going to babysit you right? Am I going to ensure you're doing things with it? Am I going to turn off what's not used? All those other kind of second phase things are the hard part. But I think this is a good thing, and I mean, I don't have a need for it, but if I was in charge of some stuff, I might give it a look.
Hey, you know how with the internet and Twitter and just the kind of rapid rate of technology evolution these days, you look at Docker and the kind of hype and bubble that it's got around itself at the moment, basically because of Twitter and how connected we all are and everything is, do you think new technologies can evolve and get deployed faster and at a wider scale than they did back in 2005 when you learned about most things via Storage Magazine, right?
Absolutely.
I think for certain.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, look at this way. The great R&D shops are all gone. Right, outside of, say, Google and Facebook and a few of these others. You know, there are no more Xerox parks to the same extent, or even the stuff that HP was doing. Where that's all taking place is in VC-funded incubators. And the way to get that stuff known is completely different than how it was getting known in the past. I mean, it wasn't like Steve Jobs is rolling into, you know, some of these companies or some of these small startups and looking at, oh, here's a mouse, a prototype. And we could use that, or here's a GUI, or some of these other technologies. You know, like if you watch that show, Halt and Catch Fire, that type of stuff doesn't happen as much as today as it used to in the past, where it was dedicated R&D dollars being spent to further the big giant company like an IBM.
Love
even
that
though those
show.
Companies still do, even though those companies still do good R&D efforts and good technology development. The vast majority of true cutting-edge technologies, I think, come from some of these people who completely think out of the box. Or, I mean, you can tell why. There was an article a couple weeks back talking about salaries for interns for specific companies. Some interns are making, you know, $7,000 a month plus $4,000 a month for housing allowance at companies like Google and Facebook and some of these others. And the reason why is they want to poach that tier one top talent out of the universities for that short period of time and then in turn bring those people in and make sure that they capture the brightest minds that are developing things in the universities that don't necessarily get the same kind of exposure in the public sphere outside of academia.
Well, it's a matter of time. You have to invest in talent, take an idea. The expectation for the time to market, or dare I say the time to money, the expectation is so high. VC funding or even if you're a straight up company that needs to make payroll, it's all about time. Time to money, and it hurts sometimes.
Jens, talking about innovation and things like that, unless you have anything further to say on those topics, let's just switch over to maybe our last topic of today's show and talk about some predictions for next year. I know it's like, oh, everybody does predictions, right? But we got to do it, right?
Yeah, it's a standard thing. It's I tell you what, if you need a blog idea, just start writing predictions. But, you know, I made two earlier about the predictions. I think we're seeing the ecosystem jump into hyperconvergence and make it stick. And
you think that's going to settle faster than, like, flash storage and stuff like that?
Yeah, yeah. You don't see the household names getting behind all the flash stuff as much. I mean, I love all the brand. I love all storage. I hate no one. But if I needed a big ass, fancy, powerful storage with a little bit of solid state, a little bit of non-rotational, a little bit of rotational, whatever the technology I want to go with, I would absolutely not buy from the top six household names of storage.
Fair play.
So I think the hyperconvergence is going to settle quicker. The other prediction I'll offer for 2015. It's kind of a softball. Give me a pass. But I actually think that vSAN will stick.
Well, it's due for 2.0, isn't it?
Yeah,
in the
is.
Early part of next year. And that'll be huge for it.
I think that might be one way the masses, ecosystem led, large name behind it. I think that might be one way that if hyperconvergence doesn't work, I think that built into the platform, a little bit of solid state, a little bit of storage, that might work. I'm really looking forward to that.
Gabriel, any thoughts?
I mean, I can muse a little bit about hyperconversion. I've never been one of these guys to do like the big prediction post every year. You know, I will say that you'll probably see one, if not two, of the hyperconverged vendors IPO this year. most certainly one. I would guess that it's probably going to be Nutanix. I mean, they are seeing a lot more success as a company who initially came out as a platform that was focused primarily on VDI that has moved more into tier one workloads. And, you know, obviously SimpliVity. And then you look at some of the other players in the space who may not quite yet be there, aka Nimbox or Pivot or Scale, who have different business models. You know, you'll start to see, I think, other companies that are going to come out with hyper-converged platforms that are more geared towards the open source community, aka OpenStack, right? Where Nebula came out as an OpenStack, kind of an OpenStack head or an OpenStack appliance, and came to market with that. And I think that they were probably a little early to market and stumbled a little bit about that. You'll see some other companies, like one I would look at is Stratoscale, right? Where they're looking at creating hyperconverged software. And then what they're going to sell is software that is container ready, OpenStack ready, that you can put on a certain list of HCL based platforms and use in your data center. And I think that's kind of where hyperconvergence is going to go, is to where you'll see some of these companies come out with software only solutions that will be geared towards, you know, kind of like what EvoRail did with, you know, being able to go to the major OEMs and say, hey, give us a base shell or a base foundation for you to put your software-defined data center technology on top. That's essentially what hyperconvergence offers. It offers you an all-in-one platform in a box. It offers simplicity and ease of deployment and integration. Now, is it perfect for everybody's workloads? No, and not every workload will work on it well, but it definitely can capture, I would say, that 70 to 80% of standard data center workloads. I think you'll see a lot more customers moving towards that model. So that's kind of where I'm sitting right now when it comes to hyperconverged.
Hey, and we read between the lines there as well, Gabriel, when you said EvoRail, what EvoRail did. So we've got a quote for next year.
Yeah, right. I've talked to several people that work on that project, and I definitely think, you know, as a first effort, it's very, you know, it's a great vehicle. If I put myself in VMware shoes, it's a great vehicle to sell a lot of VMware licensing, right? And I can sell it as a great package with all of the best practice, modules, Log Insight and VC Ops and Enterprise Plus and vSAN, and get a lot more people to buy into that vision, right? What I'm more interested, like I said, I'm definitely more interested in what EvoRack looks like. And what the vendors and who the vendors are involved with EvoRack technology, because in the place that I, you know, the space that I sell into and play into, that is definitely a much more interesting technology than what I would consider the smaller workload based, truly hyperconverged platforms today.
Okay. Hey, so I got an email from Farley earlier with a couple of predictions from him for 2015. So number one, 2015, my prediction is that it will be the year for beer.
Hey, yeah. I love beer.
And he's positioning himself well for that, isn't he? Going to all these microbrewers meetings and stuff like that. So if it is the year of beer, then Mark stands to do well out of it, I think. And then his second prediction was that Microsoft will get out of the phone business altogether. And what does he say here? Focus on making well-known apps for Google and Android phones. That's interesting. Fair play. All right, so I've got a couple of predictions here. I think probably the softball one here is, I think 2015 will be the year of the container. Probably Docker mainly, especially if Microsoft do come on board like they've said they will with the next version of Windows server platform. I also think, though, that Rocket from the guys at CoreOS will potentially provide kind of a spark to keep Docker going, and those two could be a couple of rival container technologies there that we love a war between a couple of different vendors or a couple of different companies, don't we, to keep a market going. So I think containers, huge next year. You know what else, though, I think? I think it'll be the year of the public cloud. And I know that the likes of Google and Azure and AWS have had a great year this year, but I really think next year, the kind of innovations that they're coming to market with at the moment and the kind of, I don't want to say reliability, but the kind of maturity is probably a better word. I really think that enterprises are going to start using the public cloud almost en masse next year. And I think that is to the detriment potentially of OpenStack. Now, I love OpenStack, right? I love the idea, and I really, really want it to succeed. And I know that all of the household enterprise vendors need it to succeed so that they don't just continue to bleed into the public cloud. But I'm just less excited about OpenStack on the execution front. I'm not knocking it here, right? I've got like a boatload of faith in open source and the community and what have you. But it just seems, I don't know, overly complicated and maybe too diversified still. There's so many projects going on and it's ballooning out, you know, almost in every direction. It's still really complicated. And in my opinion, from a feature perspective, it's just lagging and lagging behind the public cloud. So I'd love for 2015 to be the year for OpenStack. I'm just not convinced 2015 will be that year. I kind of hope it is, but I really do think the public cloud is going to kick on into another gear next year.
Oh, I don't doubt you there, Nigel. The key cloud platforms, especially Azure and vCloud Air, they are putting so much money into that, it has to succeed.
Period. Yeah, yeah.
You hope it succeeds, right?
No, it has to succeed. I mean, it has to.
But right? Yeah, I mean, no, I mean, you know, they've jumped all board. They've jumped all in on this. You know, and I drew a picture. I'll have to dig it up. It was kind of like, and I drew it like 2 years ago too. It was kind of like what my pyramid diagram of what the cloud space would look like, right? With that, for me, the top 10%, the tip of the pyramid was always, you know, a specific group of companies that could embrace OpenStack and leverage it to their best effect at a cost structure that was competitive against Amazon, or had regulation constraints that disallowed them from putting specific data into Amazon, right? And that was the tip of the pyramid. And those were the type of groups that were going to fully embrace OpenStack. And that was probably going to be telcos and financials and a few of these other groups that have, you know, vast, you know, they have data scientists on staff and whatnot. And then from, you know, that 10% down to 50% was going to be, you know, that entrenched IT organization that still wanted to do it themselves, wouldn't mind investing in their own private cloud internally as far as private cloud from a provisioning and automation standpoint, but still had a preponderance of need to keep control of their own IT assets to a certain extent. And then there was, you know, from 50% down below, that was all public. You know, that was, everybody else was just going to put as much stuff as they could in there. And there could be some bleed between the top of the pyramid and the bottom of the pyramid when it comes to specific workloads, but there would be only certain groups that could wholly identify with each of those three tiers.
But that has to change, doesn't it, if OpenStack is going to be a success for the likes of IBM, Cisco, HP, EMC, people like that, that they can't be having just that very, you know, top whatever percentage you said there, that they need the 50% plus.
A lot of stuff.
Otherwise,
yeah. Need a lot of
otherwise
stuff.
Their business bleeds into the public cloud.
You'd be surprised how much that top 10% spends.
Oh, I know.
That's a lot of stuff too. Don't knock that stuff.
We're not knocking any stuff, I don't think.
Okay. No, but it's always fun to prognosticate, so.
It is.
And
yeah.
You know what? For the most part, I have no idea what I'm talking about, so there's my caveat.
Well, that makes three of us, I think.
Well, that makes Rick. You the most qualified, Gabe.
Exactly.
Anything for anything else?
Nah, hey, it's been a good chat, friends.
Thanks.
Excellent. So, I'm gonna, slide out of today's show with a new feature, Captain Dogger. Is going to be a potentially a regular contributor to the show as he sails across the seas and tries to containerize everything. In this week's interview with Captain Dogger, we find out how he containerizes Santa Claus and his elves. So I think we'll slide out on that point.
Captain Dogger here. D-O-G-G-E-R. As in dog, you know. Aye, anyways, Captain of the Mighty Warship, the HMS in Tech We Trust. Aye, and a fine ship she be, disguised, mind you, as a armless container vessel. Something about containers being all the craze these days. The seas be awash with them will fit in merrily. Now you see, this mighty here battleship were specially commissioned for two things. One, seek out and destroy all virtual machines. Two, containerize everything, and I mean everything. Anyways, let me spin your yarn. You see, it nearly be that wretched time of year they call Christmas. Arr, and I don't like Christmas, nay, I don't. It's not the wee lil'uns making all the noise. Nay, and it's not the marrying and the singing. Nay, I don't mind none of that, I say. It's the big fella. You know, the big fat fella with a beard. Saint Nick, they used to call him old Santa Claus. Aye, too much fat, you see, like a virtual machine. And I can't be doing with overhead and waste like that, nay. All that waste and overhead on one fella, it's not right, and I can't be having it. Anyways, we're on a top secret mission, I tells you, by the North Pole. And what do you know? We only goes and spies the big fella himself, mind he's not hard to spot. Big and fat and bloated and all in red. So I calls for lights out and stealth mode, and we sails right up to the chubby fella. Now we grabs him and we throws him right into one of our containers. Boom! Containerized. Just like that. And all for the best. And I tell you, nae food, nae water, nae nothing. That'll trim the old fella down. You see, that's what containers are all about. Lightweight. Efficient and portable. None of the excess overheads old Saint Nick was carrying, I tell you. So we had him snagged. And it were a fart night. Later, when we went to inspect that container. And aye, what do you know, he's vanished. Vanished, arr. Turns out the containers we had at the time weren't so secure after all. Something about extracting images, following Arden soft links, and letting things break out of containers into arbitrary parts of the ship. Near good, I tell you, he was gone. So we abandoned our mission and returned to dock for new models of the containers. Now was about to head back north. Similar mission. Containerize as many of the big fella's little elves as possible. See, apparently those little fellas are perfect for containerizing. You see, he don't treat them kindly. Oh, no, 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 that's a myth. He treats them like cattle, not pets. When one of those little fellas fails, he don't fix them. Nay, I tell you, he gets rid of them. And he spins up a new one in its place. Stateless and immutable, that's what he calls them. Stateless and immutable. Oh, and they're massively scalable. There be so many of them, like wee little microservices. Aye, those little fellas, they're made for containers. Why, we'll park the ship up, open up the containers, and they'll be fighting a diving. One per container, though. That's why we have so many containers on board. Well, I must be off. Helmsman, Mr. Kubernetes, set course and take us to sea.